Please don't talk about me when I'm gone. Oh, honey, though our friendship ceases from now on. And listen, if you can't say anything real nice, it's better not to talk at all, that's my advice. We're parting, you go your way, I go mine. It's best that we do. Well, here's a kiss.
Okay, so I'm here with Brent Spiner, who is most recently the man behind the concept album Dreamland. Brent, how are you doing?
So far, so good, Ed.
Yeah, okay, we have a nice reverb in this auditorium. We'll have to take advantage of this, but...
Exactly, and please, if everyone could be quiet while I'm doing this.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Grand pronouncements. Now, okay, before I ask you a question, I will endeavor to do two things. There are two phrases, or rather a word and a phrase, that I will not mention. One rhymes with car wreck. The other one, depending upon how you pronounce your russets, rhymes with potato.
Okay.
So if I do happen to mention these or slip these in,
yes.
Please let's not call the whole thing off.
Of course.
Okay. Fair enough. But I wanted to first of all start with a general question. You recorded this album in your own recording studio, something that you co-own with Dave Way.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, how long have you had this studio? I mean, did you set this thing up with the intention of basically being some sort of music machine? Or what was that? Because I know you did Old Yellow Eyes there as well.
Well, no, I didn't do Old Yellow
you didn't?
Eyes there.
Okay.
No. I've only had this studio for a couple of years.
Oh, okay.
And Old Yellow Eyes was about, I think, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And we've just had it a couple of years, and the intention was... yes, to capture the entire music industry and make them our own.
But you were going to sell off this studio, I had heard? This recording studio, you're going to sell it off or something? Or are you still owning this?
We still own it.
Oh, you still own it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if someone wants to buy it, you know, please contact us. But at the moment, no, it's a fully operating, wonderful recording studio.
Why did you set this thing up? I mean, just in all seriousness, I'm curious. I mean, was this just something that you just wanted to have in the event that you went down this route? You wanted to have total control? Are you a control freak here? What's the deal?
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, I am a control freak, and no, that's not why I got the studio. Actually,
you went in the poker game?
Yeah. No, Dave Way, who you mentioned, Dave Way is a brilliant mixer and engineer and producer, and he... Grammy winning, I might add, many times. And he and his wife have been in the music business for a long time. She's managed several studios, Jamie, and this studio became available and they knew about it. And it was Dave's feeling that it's a big tracking studio.
Yeah.
It's not a, you know, little garage studio. It's a big studio. It looks very much like a Studio A at Capitol Records, actually. It's that size.
Yeah.
And, he was of a mind that the recording business would eventually go back to that. It had kind of gotten away from it with everybody able to build their own little studios in their houses. But that once you have a hit record, the next question is, well, can we do one that sounds like the Beatles record sounded? You know, mm-hmm. Well, the way to do that is you got to have a big tracking studio.
Yeah.
And so he convinced me that it was a good business investment, and we went into business together.
Okay. And it's making money, this recording studio.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. It is making money, but the only thing is people have to pay their bills.
Yeah.
You know.
I got you.
Yeah.
I got you. I mean, this is an interesting scenario in light of the fact that you have, I mean, I have not seen Bellarama, which is the label. I presume this is you.
That is me.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Why did you choose to self-distribute this particular CD as opposed to approaching a record company? Or did you approach a record company?
No, I really didn't. Maybe I should have done that. I don't know.
Huh.
Because it is difficult to get a record out there, as
yeah.
I'm finding out. I really thought, you know, there was just a simple process of, you know, you make it as best you can, and then you send it out, and people play it, and they listen to it, and they decide to review it or not review it or give it a good review or a bad review. And really what I found was doing it on my own. First of all, let me back up just a second. I did read an article that David Byrne wrote about the music business today and
yeah.
what's happening and the various options you have. And he sort of concluded, at least the way I interpreted it, that the best thing to do was to do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tried to do that. I sent probably 150 CDs out to newspapers and magazines, and I was not reviewed at all. I mean, like, the number was zero. And although I have a couple of online reviews that happened without me, you know, asking for them, I have had nothing from newspapers or magazines. And I really don't know what to make of it. I mean, I have to assume on some level that, first of all, these guys, these music critics, get probably, you know, 50 CDs a week minimum sent across their desks. And, you know, they look at them and they go, well, let's see, I've got R.E.M. and I've got Brent Spiner. Who should I do? Yeah, I think I'll do R.E.M.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the thinking on their parts without listening to it is that it's one of these homegrown deals that, you know, I did it in my garage or whatever, and I'm an actor singing, you know, and they're pretty sick of that. And
or that it's a vanity press or self-published outfit, I suppose.
Right, exactly, which, by the way, I have been guilty of before. I mean, in a way, Old Yellow Eyes was just a vanity project. And
but that did come out through Deadline Records, which also distributed a Bowie album, and among other things, the Black Tie White Noise.
It was not Deadline Records. It was...
Really?
No,
okay.
It was... I've never...
Maybe that was reissued or something? I saw, I was curious about this, because I wanted to compare this one versus the other one as to how it was distributed, because this is a very curious question that I have. But it wasn't Deadline Records, because that's what it says on Amazon and CD Universe and a few other places.
Does it? Because I've never even heard of Deadline Records.
Maybe there was no particular label to type in, so, oh, okay, Deadline. Maybe someone's playing a cruel joke on you. I don't know.
Well, I would go look that up, except that my computer just died. It was self-produced, and then we were picked up by a company called Bay City Records, who then went under, and they managed to then bootleg it. I mean, we made a deal with them to give us our masters back, and in lieu of any payment that they would have to give us, and then they duplicated the masters and sold them to a company called Milan in Europe, and then they were being bootlegged out there. As a matter of fact, I was in Toronto last weekend at something called Fan Expo. 50,000 people were there. And I can't tell you the number of Milan Records version of Old Yellow Eyes I signed. But anyway.
But it's also out of print now. I mean,
is out of print.
Have you thought of reinstating it, depending upon the success of this?
Yeah, well, depending upon the success of this, I have thought about doing something called Old Yellow Eyes Redux, or Redo, or however you want to pronounce it, and having Dave remaster it, and maybe even re-singing a few of the songs, because I think I'd do them better now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Back to this issue of you sending these CDs out to magazines and newspapers. Why didn't you approach blogs or even sites like Pitchfork? I mean, that specialize in this kind of thing.
I don't know about that.
Okay.
You know, I'm really ignorant. I am an actor who sings and has done this CD, you know. Really, I mean, I went so far as to, I have emailed various critics and had that, you know, saying, where exactly do I send this? And I've had them email it back to me and give me their addresses, but still I haven't seen a review.
Yeah.
And, there's a part of me that's surprised by it or disappointed by it, but then there's a part of me that's like, well, you know, I have friends I've given it to who haven't listened to it.
Yeah.
You know, I've given it to 2-3 months ago that didn't listen to it. So, how can I expect some perfect stranger to pick it up and, you know, sit through it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you about how you went about getting the rights for all of these songs. I mean, certainly that when you negotiate any song to sing, even if it can get into performance rights and mechanical rights and all of that, I mean, this had to have set you back at least something of a pretty penny.
Well, not really, because it is simple mechanicals for most parts. I mean, you know, there are a few that I had to get clearances for.
Got it.
Only because there's dialogue, or I changed them a little bit, you know. I didn't rewrite them, but I added dialogue in the middle of them.
Yeah.
And that required clearance. But the licenses for the songs were straight mechanicals.
Yeah, yeah.
And as I'm sure you know, if you've written a song and it's been produced, you're required by law to allow it to be re-recorded by somebody else as long as you pay the mechanicals for it, which is something like 9 cents a CD per song.
Speaking of the merging, I mean, I Love You and what was it? Oh, yeah, Nice and Easy. Thank you. Was there a lot of negotiation to get that worked out? Or because dealing with standards like Cole Porter and the Frank Sinatra song that this was not as serious of a I guess rights skirmish, or did they really were they very wary about you merging these particular two Confluence songs, and why were those two songs the best? I'm wondering also if you had attempted to merge other songs, but because of the mechanical rights scenario, because some people who hold the rights are very sensitive about how they are actually performed,
yes.
Whether this was possibly an issue that informed this decision to merge two songs.
Well, you know, indeed. I did that medley, if you will, required clearance.
Yeah,
I had to get permission to do that. But you know, I think I was also the person who helped me do the clearances was really clear about the fact that I wasn't doing a spoof. I wasn't making fun of them. I was going to do them very straight and very respectfully. But as it happens, on that particular piece, Cole Porter's "I Love You" was not my first choice. I had chosen Harold Arlen, "Let's Fall in Love," and is it Harold Arlen, "Let's Fall in Love"?
I do believe so.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they wouldn't allow it. The publishing company wouldn't allow it because who knows why? I mean, it's a very difficult publishing company, and actually, the clearance person saw it before we even asked for it, said, "You're not going to get this because this particular company doesn't let anybody do anything."
Really?
And
were there any songs that, I mean, which song was the most difficult to obtain rights for because of these very particular, did you get these memoranda? I've heard stories of producers essentially begging the particular writer of a song in person over the course of like a 3-day period in person, please let me use your song.
I didn't have any difficulty like that. I mean, these people were like, okay, you know, that sounds like a reasonable thing to do. We showed them the context in which we were using it, and it wasn't, again, it's completely respectful, and it's not in any way, you know, doing anything to the song that makes it less than what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting rights was, particularly the licenses, most of them are sung straight through just the way they're written. So there was no problem. You just license them and they give you the license and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In terms of some of the sounds that you use on this particular CD, I know that DJ Giogni is credited for tap dancing, and yet I noticed when I had heard this album that the footfalls were very heightened and more pronounced, and I'm wondering if DJ, Mr. Giogni, was responsible for these footfalls as well. It seemed that you almost needed to kind of spread the wealth here in terms of what tap dancing he did, or what happened
here?
Well,
no, DJ tapped. I mean, there's only one little tap sequence, and he did that, and the rest of them were, you know, we either produce them ourselves or grab them from, you know, old, you know, sound effects.
Really? How much did you rely upon old sound effect libraries? Which ones did you use?
Well, just, you know, tons of them. I mean, you mean which specific sound effects packages did we pull them from?
I'm just curious.
I have no idea because I didn't do that. I mean, I sat there while we were doing it, but, you know, I was not curious.
Yeah.
So I never said to Dave, "What package is that from exactly?" You know, I mean, he had a large, huge number of effects.
And he played them back from you, and this was the ideal footfall.
We would choose them.
Okay.
Yeah, we would choose them because for every footfall you hear, there were, you know, 50 possibilities.
Yeah.
So we listened to all of them, and we'd say, "No, I think that's the one." And if we didn't have the one we liked, we produced it ourselves.
There is also one thing I noticed when Maud, her character, asks for directions to El Parador. There's a maraca that shakes on the left speakers.
Nice.
I wanted to ask whether this was intended as a cue to the listener. Or is this are you confessing yourself to be a Zapatista or something, or what happened?
You know what? That was, you really listened to it. I appreciate that. Thank you. That John McKinney, who did the arrangements, and Dave Way and I basically sat together for 6 weeks cutting this. And because Dave originally said, "I can edit this in a week." Mm-hmm. And about the second day, he called me and said, "You know, I think you better come over because this is not like editing a CD. This is like editing a movie. And I think it's going to take a lot longer. And there are a lot of decisions that are going to have to be made." And so we brought Mac in too because he's, you know, a brilliant musician and has a great ear and is a really smart guy. And the three of us debated everything. But it was Mac who chose to throw that maraca in. And it was from another, it was from a song somewhere else in the CD.
Mm-hmm.
And he just was sitting there. He said, "Hey, you know, there is a maraca that would be kind of fun to throw in when she mentions El Parador.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And he did.
Did you do this throughout the tracks, throughout the album, that there are various cues to other songs along these lines?
There are, yeah. And they appear in other places. I mean, there's this little piece when he sees her the first time, and then he sees her again in El Parador. There's a little music, little piece of music right there that says, that's him seeing her.
Yeah.
And that came from somewhere else on the CD as well.
In terms of conceiving the narrative, I wanted to ask you about this. I was listening to this with my girlfriend, and she immediately turned to me and said, oh, yes, older man, younger woman, the standard musical trope. And I said, but this is audio. This is I did come to your defense.
Thank you.
And I basically said, well, we don't know the age of this character.
Yeah.
And yet, you, Maude's character is referred to as younger woman. I mean, was
she
this
is?
At one point early on, I believe sometime midway through the first act, she is referred to specifically, or when he's first singling her out, she's saying young woman. And I'm wondering.
But he doesn't say he's not a young man.
That's true. But generally,
why would she say that, by the way? Why would your girlfriend say older
well, because
man,
she's
younger woman?
Probably because she's sick and tired of the musical trope and all that. I mean,
I understand. But, but what said to her, he's older and she's younger?
See,
I mean,
that's the question I present to you.
Is it that she knows what I look like and she knows what Maude looks like? And so she just made that assumption?
You know, I have no idea. I think maybe that might have been it. But I mean, I'm wondering if this was a concern. Speaking of this, people associate you as a particular type,
yes.
And as such, when you're transferring this to audio, and you have a very distinctive and recognizable voice, was this a consideration in crafting the narrative? I know that for a lot of the dialogue, you have a muffled delivery, a softer delivery than what you usually do. You're more normal in your speaking.
Yeah.
Did you want to try to remove yourself from the kind of wild and eccentric spiner vocals that we are very familiar with in your acting work?
I mean, I wanted him to be just kind of a regular guy, you know, and to give it that sort of the sort of innocence that I think that the piece has. And when I think about noir films and who the guy walking through them, you know, not a tough guy, not a gangster, but just a regular Joe, that's what I wanted him to be. Mm-hmm. And but you know, it's interesting you bring up this whole older man, younger woman thing, because I've been talking to someone about the possibility of doing it live, and just recently, actually, and a director, and I said to her, the only problem I have is that if I do it, it takes on a whole different meaning, because then it is an older guy and a younger woman. And she goes, well, it's a dream, and you know, who knows how old he is in the dream, and. And I said, I know, maybe we should get somebody else to do my part. And she said, oh, but so much of it is about the fact that you're doing it. And so I don't know, now that I have to listen to your girlfriend and go, hey, that's exactly what I was saying. Maybe there's a problem with that. Maybe I need to get someone else to do it.
Maybe she responded this way because he does come across as quite intense in the very beginning in his pursuit of her. And gradually things become a little bit more, it's a normal romantic story. But in fact, that actually alarmed me a little bit. I was like, well, he's really, really intense. Like, hey, baby, that kind of thing. I mean, granted, this particular genre has a history of this kind of intensity.
Right.
But it's interesting framing that in the early 21st century, and now we have differences in terms of mores and folk ways, and people might make assumptions. I mean, did you consider this in concocting the narrative at all?
Or? No, actually, I was able to allow for anything because it's a dream.
Yeah.
You know, nothing ever really concerned me. I didn't have to say, well, would that really happen, or would someone really do that, or would anything, because it's a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And but I have to say this, that if I do make the decision to do it live, and I don't know whether, I don't think it's going to be particularly like a Broadway show, but more like some kind of odd concert with visuals and blocking and staging and effects and stuff like that. That's sort of the way I see it. If I choose not to do it, ultimately, it is your girlfriend's fault. And I just want her to know that.
We'll blame her. Okay, fantastic. I also wanted to ask you about Please Don't Talk About Me When I'm Gone. This reminded me very much of Toot Toot Tootsie from the first album, this kind of belting quality that you have. I have heard this in your acting, but I did try to go through some of your Broadway performances, what I was able to find, and I couldn't find that particular belting. Whoa, whoa, whoa! You know, that thing that you do in those particular songs. And I'm wondering how this you first started singing like this, and how the relationship between between your character roles and your singing came about. I mean, they play off of each other, it would seem, with this.
You know what, really? I'm just sort of like George Plimpton in show business. I mean, I just like to try it all, you know?
You wrestle too, I presume.
I do wrestle, and I sing while I wrestle, actually, but it's a completely different sound than you've ever heard before. I had never before Old Yellow Eyes done that kind of crooning sound that I think I'm better at now than I was then. I'm trained on Broadway stage. You know, I've done 5 musicals on Broadway, and that involves singing out. You know, and so to belt for me is way more natural than crooning. I'm more trained at being able to do that. Yeah. It's when I start singing opera that you're really going to be surprised.
Why haven't you presented opera with?
Well, I thought about it on this. Actually, I was going to do Ness and Dorma, and then I thought, nah. But you know, I'll tell you, when I do sing opera, I know what you're going to say to yourself. This guy is even better than Paul Sorvino.
Wow, yeah. those are incredible words to live up to, sir.
Well, I think I can do it. I really do.
Bringing in Mark Hamill into this is interesting to me from a purely subconscious level because, as you know, I don't want to mention the words, but there are 2 popular science fiction franchises, and it occurred to me that on a subconscious level you might have attempted to bridge the gap between the rancor and the acrimony that each of them are, because you had Patrick Stewart, of course, and other people on the first album.
Right.
Was this ever on your mind, this kind of, well, hey, guess what? You can also drink Pepsi or Coke, too. You know?
Yes, exactly. Well, no. Frankly, I mean, it was just a lucky accident, really. Yeah. It turns out, I know Mark a little bit, not well, but Mac McKinney, who did the arrangements, was the orchestrator for Harrigan and Hart, a Broadway show of 1985, I believe, and that starred Mark Hamill. And they became very good friends, and Mark's career subsequently has been, a great deal of it has been in doing voice work for a lot of great cartoons and things, and I was familiar with that because I have a 6-year-old who watches a lot of cartoons, so I'd seen that Mark did that kind of work. And we needed someone to do all of the other men on the, you know, and give us a lot of variety, and Max said, well, the perfect person is Hamill, and I said, can we, you know, will he do it? And we sent him the script and asked him to do it, and he came in and knocked it out of the park.
I also want to ask you about the hotel. Now, this is a rather unusual question, but I should observe you grew up in Houston.
Yes.
And there was, of course, for a long time, the Shamrock Hilton was there. And what is rather unusual is that it was demolished in June 1987, which almost exactly coincides with your big break on the show that shall not be named. But I was wondering if you have ever contemplated this connection and whether the hotel may have jumped out because of this, or why did you choose the hotel? And what of the Shamrock Hilton?
You know what, Ed? I'm not sure what the question is, really. But and I'm not even sure you know what the question is.
No, no. I'm just throwing associations at
you.
I figured you can handle this.
Let me say, and I will say the word. I did Star Trek purposefully because of the demise of the Shamrock Hotel. I mean, there was other reason I took that job. When they told me...
That Houston was dead to you.
Houston was dead to me once the Shamrock Hilton was gone. But let me just say this. How do you know about the Shamrock Hilton?
I just am curious.
Are you from Houston at all?
No, I'm not. I've never actually been in Texas, aside from, I believe, a layover. But I knew about it. I knew that big people came through there. And so I figured you hung out there when these big people... kind of made their way through.
I once saw Mel Torme at the Shamrock pool walk past. And even more importantly, I once saw Jock Mahoney doing chin-ups outside by the Shamrock pool.
Did you talk with these folks when you were there?
You know what? I didn't. I wished I'd talked to Jock Mahoney, which is another story altogether. But I did spend my youth at the pool at the Shamrock Hilton Hotel, as did every other kid I knew, because it was still the single largest swimming pool I've ever seen. It was gigantic. And it wasn't just because I was a child that it looked gigantic.
Yeah, of course, they always the situation there. But
because I was a teen. I mean, I went to the Shamrock until I left Houston to go to college. But the Shamrock, it was a magic place. It really was. And to put it into context, you've seen the film Giant, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, the hotel that Jet Rink opens in Giant is the Shamrock Hilton yes. Hotel. That's what it's based on. He was playing a character. Jett Rink was based on Glenn McCarthy, who was called the Wildcatter. He was a Texas oil man who hit it big, and he originally built the Shamrock Hotel, and then the Hilton Company bought it from him.
Yeah.
But it was one of those magical places to grow up. They had the best hamburgers by the pool. My folks were always there. Their friends were there. It was huge. I can't even describe how big the pool was. But it was also fun as kids to go through the tunnels in the hotel and work our way, you know.
But this is really sad because it's no longer there. What will the kids of Houston who followed you have as their great giant Olympic-sized pool? I don't know.
They have nothing.
They have
nothing to amuse them.
And
now,
you can sit there and laugh like a maniacal person pointing out at the wonders of the older ages that they can't live.
It really is a shame that Houston, like Los Angeles, has no real respect for its history.
Yeah.
You know, tear it down is the deal.
Yeah.
And it's a shame.
I know also that you studied with Cecil Peckett. And,
Pickett.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. And I know that the Brothers Quaid were also part of them. Are you in touch with the Brothers Quaid in any sense? Did you ever, or any of the other Pickett-esques?
Sure. We don't really, you know, like, get together frequently, but I do run into them from time to time, and we're always happy to see each other. Mm-hmm. And there were other people, as you say, Tommy Schlamme, who...
Yeah.
Directed The West Wing and produced and Studio 60 and dozens of other pilots and things. We grew up together, and he was in Mr. Pickett's class, and we're still great friends. And I see Randy and Dennis now and then. I worked with Randy briefly in Independence Day. Of course, I'll never be working with him in the theater because he's been, you know, lifetime banned from Actors Equity. But which is a distinction, I think. It's a dubious distinction, but it's never happened in the history of Actors Equity.
Yeah.
And of all people, my old high school buddy, Randy Quaid, was... It's just amazing when you make the leap from... I can remember doing a play. I was a year ahead of Randy. And doing a play, which is hard to believe. I am actually older than he. But we were doing a play in high school, or he was... And I was just there seeing it, and he was in a panic because he'd forgotten his hat, which was part of his costume. And he came up and he says, "Brent, please, please, can you drive me home really quickly and get me back in time for the curtain? Mr. Pickett's going to kill me if I don't have the hat." And I was like, "All right, come on." We got in the car and I drove him home, and he went in and got his hat. We got back, and Mr. Pickett met us at the door, furious that we had risked, you know, him being late for the curtain. But
wow.
That kid, that little kid who was so frightened that you know, you jump 40 years or whatever, and he's now been banned from Actors Equity for life. It's life is a strange thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. That actually, I'm very curious. I did a lot of research on you, and you had mentioned in an interview with the Houston Chronicle in 1987, I like to think of myself as the Rutger Hauer of this show, but then I like to think of myself as Rutger Hauer in real life, strikingly handsome, irresistible to women, an intergalactic enigma. Now, beyond, of course, the connotations of the show that shall not be named, I wanted to ask you about your current feelings for Rutger Hauer.
Yeah.
Now, things have changed in 20 years.
Well,
and
truly,
are you more like Rutger Hauer now? Are you less like Rutger Hauer now? Or
you know what? I say this with all humility and deep respect for Rutger Hauer, that I feel he probably is now telling people he thinks of himself as the Brent Spiner of the universe.
Do you have any hard evidence for this? Or?
No, I don't really. I actually one time was, now I shouldn't tell this story, but I did sit next to Rutger Hauer at an event, and I was at this event with Whoopi Goldberg, and Rutger Hauer was sitting next to us, and when he sat down, Whoopi went, "Ugh," and I went, "What?" And she went, "Rutger." And I went, "You know Rutger?" "Mm-hmm." And so she said, "I don't want to talk to him." I said, "Okay." About this time, a tap on my shoulder from Rutger, and he says, "Change places with me." And I said, "Well, I hang on just a second." I went, "Whoopi, Rutger wants me to change places with him." She said, "Okay." So I changed places, and Rutger sat next to Whoopi.
Well, was there any explanation for this?
You know what? There was, but I don't want to really share it because it could be a betrayal, and I don't know. I just don't know enough. I mean, I'm not sure what you know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting in light
little
of your comparison to him.
I know, of all people, but, Rutger Hauer.
Because Whoopi gets along with you. Therefore, you would think that, you know, given the clear comparisons here.
Yeah, that could be it. You know, it could be that she saw the Rutger in me, which is why she wanted to go out with me. But I think other people have seen the Rutger Hauer in me. And frankly, as I look in the mirror today, I'm starting to see the Rutger Hauer of me, which is...
Well,
scary.
So long as you aren't menacing various motorists and the like, hopefully you'll be okay.
No, indeed.
In an interview you conducted with the podcast Reality Check, you took umbrage with a YouTube commenter who's on the video that was posted there, who suggested that you had hired Maud because you weren't confident in your own voice.
Oh, yeah.
But this is just a YouTube commenter. I mean, it's not Frank Rich or Mel Gusso here. I mean,
right.
So why are you not impervious to criticism, or why care about...
I'm not impervious to stupidity. You know, it's fine with me if someone doesn't like something, mm-hmm. you know, that I've done. I get it. I mean, that's perfectly fair. Taste is taste, you know. But if you say something stupid, then you have to be told that it's stupid, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, that was just a dumb thing to say, you know, that... What was it that I hired Maud because...
Because you didn't have enough confidence in your own
voice. Because I didn't have enough confidence in my own voice, so I got a great singer to sing with me. Well, that's dumb. You know, if you don't have confidence in your voice, you don't get someone who's better than you to sing with you. You get someone who's worse than you, so you sound good.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, what steps do you take to assess your own performances, or do you have a bunch of people who you consult to really ensure that, you know, you can trust them, that they will actually give you the hard truth? Like, okay, Brent, I got a level with you.
Yeah.
You didn't hit this. You didn't do that. I mean, what do you do to kind of improve your
performance? Yeah, I had Dave and Matt co-producing with me. And so they were very open about saying, you know, I think you should do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting how those things work out. First of all, I hired Maud because... I heard her sing and I was knocked out, and I just thought, this is the best vocalist in the world today. Who wouldn't want to sing with her?
How like them apples?
Yeah, and she's fantastic. Yeah. And most of the tracks, well, first of all, Maud's tracks are almost all first takes. I mean, she can just do it every time. She's that good. She's that skilled. She is a singer. I am not a singer. I am a actor who sings, or I'm a person who acts and sings.
Mm-hmm.
But one night before we ever went into the studio, we were in Dave's studio. He has a studio himself, and he said, "Look, you have I thought my BlackBerry was going off, and I needed to turn it off there." He said, "Look, the orchestra tomorrow is going to start coming in various bits and pieces, and they need a track to go by, you know, more than just a click track. It would be nice if they could hear how you're singing the songs, how you intend to sing them, so they can get at least a feeling from them. So why don't you sing everything tonight, and these are just temp tracks, and we'll play them for them." And so I sang everything that night, and at the end of the day, after recording and recording and re-recording and redoing songs and thinking about them again and redoing them, most of my tracks are the ones we did that night.
Yeah.
Because I was relaxed and there was no pressure and I just sang. And that's what we wound up using.
I know we're running out of time, but I have two quick questions that I'll throw at you, and hopefully we can get some answers here. One involves your signing on to The Show That Shall Not Be Named, and also other things, plays and the like. You signed on for The Show That Shall Not Be Named. I feel pretty good about that. For a 6-year contract, figuring that it would fizzle out in a year. And yet
you know,
you were...
only not named by you. I am allowed to say it.
Well, I'm trying to be the better gentleman.
No, it's all right. Don't worry about it.
I know you get heckled a lot for the show that you were associated with.
That's okay.
But I'm not naming.
You don't have to.
Yeah. But I'm wondering if where you stand on, say, a commitment like this, whether it's a play run or whether it is unintentionally being hooked onto a show for 6 years. I mean, I'm wondering if that was the case with Threshold, which you recently had done and it had died after a season. And
I don't want you saying Threshold either, if you don't mind.
Okay. I figured that was fair game because they're not going to call you Brent Threshold Spiner.
Well, I don't know. Some people do.
Really? And there was another question, but but let's talk about this one first.
Yeah. What is the question?
Oh, the question is how you deal with, I guess, a commitment, a long-term commitment along these lines. I mean, before the show that shall not be named, you had not worked on anything probably for more than, 4 months.
Right.
At a stretch.
It's
and then
true.
So how do you deal with this, I guess... potentially interminable scenario whenever you sign on for anything, or do you just not worry about it? Do you just let things happen and you just go ahead and go for a ride?
I worry about it. I really do, because as you say, I mean, I signed on to to Star Trek because I really did think it was just going to run a year. I thought, well, that's it. You know, this cannot be a success. They had pre-sold it for a year, so I knew I was going to be there a year.
Yeah.
But I figured that's got to be it, because you can't redo Star Trek. That's ridiculous. And but it was a sweet part, so I thought, well, I'll have a go at that and pay off some bills and happily walk away at the end of the year.
Yeah.
I don't relish the idea of a long gig like that. I mean, Threshold, I said okay, and... I would have been happy to get a year out of Threshold, but we only got half a season, I think, out of Threshold.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, did you sign like a multi-year contract?
Yes, you have to.
Yeah.
But I didn't think, I don't know. You know, the chances of something lasting more than 3 or 4 years are slim. I mean, you think of a show like Alias, for example. Alias was a hit, right?
Yeah.
Did it go 5 years? I think 5 years,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. I could do it. The fear, the big fear of that is that you're going to sign on to something that you're going to hate doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there could be really happy situations. You know, I would have been happy to be on, I don't know what I would have been happy to be on, but doing a half hour is such easy work in comparison to film work, hour-long film work.
Yeah.
That... I think one could probably do that and be fairly happy doing half hour, because if it's not stupid. I mean, if you're on something like Frasier David's show.
Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Curb Your Enthusiasm, or something that you could be proud of at the same time that you're enjoying yourself.
But if you can't anticipate being proud of it in advance, you don't. I mean, what do you do to?
Well, it's based on the pilot, really. You know, if it's a pilot that you think, well, this could be interesting for a long while, but I am afraid of that, and I turned down a lot of not work, but auditions and appointments and meetings for things that I think I could not do this for 7 years if it comes to it. There's no way.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it for 4 episodes, you know, so I know I can't do it.
Well, given these circumstances, how do you find the balance between art versus commerce? Something like Dreamland, which is obviously a labor of love, versus something that's definitely going to pay the bills but may not necessarily be artistically fruitful. You may get stuck in a rut. And of course, with television in general, you end up having very little latitude when it comes to playing a particular character, because, you know, how dare we actually adjust the character like human life, because we want the audience to come in and we want them to know exactly what they're getting. How do you negotiate that? How do you make something like that fun? Or you just can't really make a call?
I don't know if you can, you know. That's why it is better to do your own projects, you know, because at least you started it and you're responsible for it. And I mean, Dreamland took a lot longer than I thought it would. And it's still continuing to take time. But it's taking time just because I would like to recoup my investment, you know, so I'm having to sell it.
Yeah.
And and I still am deluding myself that eventually some of these critics are gonna wind up putting it on and listening to it and going, oh my goodness, I had no idea this is actually a lot of work went into this. It's really a massively produced item. It's not just some garage recording, you know.
But I guess the question is if it is better to do your own projects, or even to appear on, say, like an off-Broadway play or whatnot, then why not continue doing something like that? Why sign up for something like Threshold,
which I will name? Well, because I have a family who I have to support in the style that they've become accustomed to, and although I'd like to accustom them to a more, you know, humble style, they at this point, and I'm included, are kind of spoiled, you know. And I would like to cut back and just do the things that appeal to me and not have to think about commerce whatsoever.
Then why not make some hard decisions and just, I guess, whack down the way that you live?
Well, I probably will ultimately, and I'm sort of been doing that. I mean, you haven't seen me in anything. The only thing you've seen me in recently is a superhero movie, yeah. And that was just because Craig Mazin, the director, writer, asked me to do it. You know, when I'm hard pressed to say no when somebody asks me to the party. You know, if it's just something I think I can do, then I'll do it. But that wasn't like a big payday either. You know, that was just the director asked me to do it. Yeah. But I've said no to a lot of stuff because of that very reason.
Have you said no to any particular roles that you regret saying no to, that you could have perhaps expanded who you are beyond the character who shall not be named?
No, I have not. I have really not. And I point that out to my managers all the time. I say, look, see, I turned that down and it went nowhere.
Yeah.
But I have been said no to about things that I wish I had done, and I think they made a mistake in not using me.
Yeah. So it still remains just as much of a struggle to get work now it was when you first came to New York. I mean, you managed to get work, I know, in 6 months within getting here, which is actually extraordinary. Is the formula of tenacity, talent, and luck really, has it changed much in the last 30 years for you? Or?
No, not really. Oh, a little bit, you know, in that I can pretty much get through the door if I ask to go through the door. You know, I can meet people if I want to. If I see a role I think I'm right for, I can often get a shot at it if I really want to do it. Whereas you don't have that option when you're a kid. You know, you're just, plus you don't care. When you're a kid, you just want to work. It's not like, you know, there's something to be said for that too, I think, for just being open to do anything because you just want to be part of the game.
Is that why you ultimately moved to LA from New York, that you just wanted to work, or did you want to get bigger? What was the situation?
I wanted to make an adult living, which is why I moved to LA.
Yeah.
I mean, and part of me regrets it.
How would you define adult living?
Well, adult living in that I didn't want to live like
a pauper?
I just didn't want to live like a college student anymore. I was clearly an adult. I was 34 when I moved to Los Angeles. And at that point, I was still living like a college student, you know? I mean, just eking by every month, paying my rent, you know, barely paying my rent, and even occasionally having to hit up my family for money. And I had kind of enough of that and thought, you know, it's time to actually be living like an adult if I can. So I moved to the place where they actually pay you to do it.
But at the same time, there are people who have to stick it out for years and have to live like a college student. Then roughly people then come around to figuring out, oh, well, this person is talented on their own particular terms. You mentioned regretting that?
Oh, sure. But it happens. But then more often, it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, more often, those people live like college students the rest of their lives, you know, and don't have the opportunity to have families and own a house and, you know, do things that adults do.
Yeah.
You know, and that's okay. I mean, there's no judgment on that. And yeah, I have, I tell you what I've regretted is, if anything, is that I didn't, when the series was over, didn't just come back to New York. Mm. I mean, I've been twice doing shows.
Yeah.
But just to live here full time, I think would have been my taste, really.
Well, Brent, thanks so much for taking the time out. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks.
Pleasure, Ed. Say hi to your girlfriend. Tell her it's all her fault, by the way.